Welcome to Hallel Fellowship on the internet at hallel.info. Today, we dug into amazing passages in Genesis 24, verses 42 through 67, Isaiah 12, verse 3 through chapter 14, verse 2, and James 4, verses 13 through 17. And wow, did we unpack Abraham's approach to marriage? It's not just about finding a spouse, but about trusting God's guidance. We looked at six key principles, like choosing someone who shares your faith, involving parents wisely, and praying for direction. The big takeaway? God's got a plan, and when we align with it, life gets pretty incredible.
Key themes that really link them all together here today, there really are some three major elements, which is divine guidance and humility, and God's sovereignty over human plans. And so we would look at them specifically about the divine guidance and what in ancient times, you'll even see that in our founding documents with Providence with a capital P is what's talking about that divine guidance in the history of people. And the first section we're looking at Genesis 24, you see that Abraham's servant is praying for God's direction and finding a wife for Yitzhak or Isaac. And God answers him by leading him to Rivka or Rebecca there. And so that is really reflecting the idea that God orchestrates events for his purposes. And we talk a lot about the Le'olam Va'ed, which is a phrase in Hebrew that is often translated forever and ever. But you can even take it more literally to say le'olam, or to the world, or to the horizon, va'ed, and beyond. So we are not only worshiping the God who listens, but the God who sees, and sees over the horizon past where we can see. So when we are getting promises from the Almighty, and getting these predictions and prophecies of things that will come to pass, that is seen out beyond where we can see out into the future. And so secondly, in the passage we see in Isaiah, we see that God's sovereignty and his deliverance are at work, because you'll see that contrast of Israel's salvation and Babylon's downfall. Because here you're talking about the downfall when Yeshayahu the prophet was penning this. Babylon was a great power. So the idea that Babylon would be coming down would be saying something like some great power, some great nation, like the United States or some other great power, that it would come down. And people would think, oh, that would be unthinkable. But you see that God in this passage is really emphasizing the fact that he is exalting the humble and bringing down the proud. We saw that a little bit with the passage we were looking at in Nehemiah chapter 9 earlier today in our services. There's a similar thing of Israel being proud that it had the words of God, but didn't pay attention to any of them. So thus started wandering off and needed multiple timeouts and in increasing severity over time to get back on track. And we see that this is really, again, aligning with this message that God is trying to move human plans back into the realm of the Creator. People may think that the world will just go on and on being separated from the Creator, but it's a very apt thing that the Apostle Paul talks about, that the whole creation groans for the sons of God to be revealed, for the sons, all the children of God to be revealed, because through that revelation and that remembering of who the Creator is part of the restoration plan back to all things, hitting the restore defaults. You know, if you're working on something like software or something like that, and you say restore defaults, or even on your phone, when it says restore carrier settings, yeah, that's what they call the nuclear option on your phone, because what's going to happen? You're going to lose all of your previous connections. All your Wi-Fi logins, all of that stuff is going to get lost. So that's something that when we see in the grand scheme of the world, that heaven is really restoring the world to the factory settings or the creator's settings of it. How the creator made all things. And in the process, a lot of the connections that we think are so important today are just going to get lost. And in a sense, even today, when you're faced with that decision, do you hit the restore defaults button? You have to be willing to say, I let all that stuff go. And so we today also have to realize, are we willing to let all of the previous connections, the things that we thought were so important to the things of this world that will just end and disappear, are we willing to let those things go? And rounding things out with our passages today, in the passage there in James chapter 4, the Apostle Yaakov, in that sense, is warning us about the arrogance in making these future plans without considering God's authority. Because just like we were saying, this is to beat our poor metaphor to death about our cell phones. You know, if you know that, hey, you're really going to need to restore it to factory settings, then you go on willy-nilly and set all sorts of things and parameters on your phone and load this and load that. When you know you need to actually hit the reset button, when you know you need to do that, what is it that you're actually doing? You're moving on with the arrogance. Oh, I know the way that I need to go. Even when you have it in the back of your head, no, I'm going to have to let all that go as well. So that's what the theme is here really today. And interestingly enough, when we see all of these things together, it's about faith, trust. Trust in God's plan is actually the correct way to go. The one who sees, the one who listens, who's seen Le'olam Va'ed, and is now telling us about the things that will be, because he is the one who made things as they are, that we can trust that is actually the correct way to go. You know, in modern society, people can get so enamored with their GPS guidance systems and get themselves into all kinds of trouble. But why? You trust things because why? They see things that you can't. You don't know what the roads are going to look like in the next town or even in your own town you're going to. But yet you trust that system is going to get you to where you need to go. So some people who have encountered lots of problems with the system and getting them to the places they need to go will turn that system on less and less. So that's one of the things that we, over time, and we've seen in Avraham's life, that he had to learn that kind of trust, that kind of dependence upon heaven, and seeing that he was being led first from the city of where he was there in Mesopotamia to a different land, and then being led to one degree to another, and being shown that the ways of all the nations around him were not the way that it was ultimately the plan for what heaven was planning to do with him, to be a blessing for all nations, that through him, the blessing that was promised from the beginning of the world would be brought forward and would be made actual. So let's take a look at the Genesis 24 passage, something very interesting in that here today. And you can say it's really Avraham's sixfold view of marriage, and you see that unfolding in the account that we have seen in Genesis 24 and some companion passages. And we see that in the first view of marriage that Avraham has is faith in God. Because you see that Avraham trusted God was going to carry out this promise of the covenant, this deal, this promise that was going to come out, was going to go on to the next generation and next generation and next generation beyond. Because by this point, who was he marrying off? son? Yes, the son of the promise. So that you see, promise made, promise kept. So thus, the one that is making promises and carrying them further is saying, okay, I've kept my promise here. Will you trust me to go on to the next step? And you see an example of that in the passage we saw here today with Genesis 24:50, where you see Laban and Betuel. We've talked a lot about Laban in our last passage last week and saw that there is a very interesting duplicitous nature. And as we go on through Genesis, we'll see Laban is not a straight dealer. And you see some shades of that even in the account here today. It's like, oh, don't leave yet. How about stay a week? You know, how about this? Well, maybe ask her or see if she really wants to leave. This delay. And we'll see that ratcheted up even further as the account goes forward into next generations. But one of the things that you see the acknowledgement of it is here is, well, okay, this matter comes from the Lord. And that should be an acceptance of what the actual source of this message is, that the message comes from the Lord. So thus, that's what we should actually be following. And we saw that in our passage also in from the Apostle Yaakov today in James chapter 4, verse 15, where it use is it, you should instead say, if the Lord wills. And you probably have heard that from yesteryear. You know, people are, quote, old-timey, old quote, will say, will preface things by saying, well, if the Lord wills. And it's very interesting that you use that, quote, old-timey sort of comment, even with fellow believers, and I say, well, you know, if the Lord wills, I'll be there. And it was taken to be, oh, you're trying to get out of it. By prefacing it with, if the Lord wills. So that's like, okay, so you're going to have a divine intervention and keep you from actually keeping your promise and showing up. Rather, and back in the old timey days where, remember the aphorism of words, a man's word is his bond. Thus, okay, when you're saying something, you're making a promise and making it as if it's a bond. It's like a contract that has punishments if you don't follow through with them. And meaning, you know, especially with a bond, you're going to lose the money if it's like a secular bond that you might have that you're going to do something. But with this, with a promise, okay, you're saying, I am indeed going to do that. There will be some pain to me if I don't follow through with the things that I say I'm going to do. But this is the apostle saying, step back from that a little bit. Okay, you say you're going to do that, and you fully intend to follow through on that. But have you considered your promise and how that factors into the grand scheme and the grand unfolding of how God is working on the planet? Have you considered that at all in the promises that you say you're going to do in this and that? So on the second part of the sixfold view that Avraham has about marriage being within the context of faith or trust, because Avraham is seeking this spouse for Yitzhak from his own kindred, who have come to believe in the one true God rather than from the surrounding Canaanite peoples. Because remember that refrain, don't go to the people here. Don't go to the people who live here. Go somewhere else. Go back to my family roots here. Because remember, and when we first met up with the family of Avraham back in Genesis chapter 12, Avraham was called out, and a number of his family came with him part of the way. And when so he's going back to his family, they have come out part of the way from Mesopotamia, from the land that they were in before. So they've gone part of the way, not fully all the way out, and not fully all the way into the culture of Canaan at the time, and its varying views of how heaven is really acting upon earth, because you see some examples of that from the encounters that Avraham has with Avimelech over there in modern day Gaza area, but that coastal area, that Avimelech has a grasp and a true fear of the Lord that is governing his behavior and seeing, okay, there are certain behaviors that I should not do just because I'm king and I'm powerful. And I see a pretty woman and I will take my prerogative as king and just take her. Well, no, he has at least some sort of fear of the Lord. And so he realizes when this is something, a road that he does not want to go down anymore, because why? He trusts this voice. May not fully understand it, may not fully follow it, but he's at least listening to it. And that's a voice that he has some trust in. So when Avraham is going for someone from a marriage partner for his son Yitzhak, he's saying, I do not want those two to be on a different page from each other. So he's looking to have them both being on the same page with each other in that process. And you see that in how the family is acknowledging, hey, this is a bone of my bone. These are relatives, and coming to have this marriage be a part of the same ideology set. And we've talked about this before, is that you can have people that are very different from each other. They come from different countries. They come from different ethnicities and this and that and the other. But if they have the same beliefs and the same core structures and the idea of the things that are eternal, they may have more in common with someone from another country than maybe someone from their own country. And we see that in the body of Messiah. We can have a lot of things in common with, you know, when we were over in Uganda, there was a lot of things that I had in common, more in common with the brothers and sisters that we met in Uganda than I would have with my own colleagues at work. We're far more on the same page, even though those people live thousands of miles away from me here. They are closer to me than even people I sit next to every day of the week, of the work week. So thus you can see that having that kind of yoking together is very important to be on the same page with things. So another part of Avraham's sixfold view of marriage, about the parental involvement and the submission to the parents. Now, this is something we'll talk about further, but you see that both Yitzhak and Rivka were willing to submit to their parents' choices in the matter of marriage, you know, trusting that God would work through their parents to secure their life mate. Okay, this has a lot of things going on under the hood. Because for you to be trusting your parents, there is a lot of, you could say, culture of honor going on here, but also a lifetime of trusting your parents over time. But then your parents, on the flip side, also have to be, we call that trustworthy. Worthy of that kind of trust, so that your children then will be saying, oh, yes, I trust that what you're talking about in your decisions are the way that I need to go. Because one of the things that is a big question is, what if parents want to rule over the marriage thereafter? And that can be an extreme challenge that can happen, especially for, you say, the stereotypical mother-in-law. Now, those stereotypes can be way overblown and this and that and the other, but they come from somewhere. And that's kind of coming from somewhere. I know from my own connections, I won't go into anything further than that, that those stereotypes have borne out to be true. In most of the cases that I know of, those things had to be true. So what then do you do with those sorts of things? And we have some instructions there about that in marriage, that the Creator has really designated the couples are to leave their families and become one flesh. And we get those from Genesis 2:24 and Matthew 19:6 and Mark 10:9. Let's take a look at one of those passages here further on with Matthew 19, starting in verse 3 and going through verse 11. Some of the Perishim came to Yeshua, testing him and asking, "Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any reason at all?" He answered and said, "Have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female? And said, 'For this reason, a man shall leave his father and his mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh.' So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate." They said to him, "Why then did Moshe command to give her a certificate of divorce and send her away?" He said to them, "Because of your hardness of hearts, Moshe permitted you to divorce your wives. But from the beginning, it has not been this way. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife, except for immorality, and marries another, commits adultery." The students said to him, "If the relationship of the man with his wife is like this, it is better not to marry." But he said to them, "Not all men can accept this statement, but only those to whom it has been given." And so we see another exception. It comes up there in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, where the Apostle Paul is also talking about marriage relationships and things. And he mentions in there in verse 15 that if you have an unbelieving spouse and is divorcing a believing spouse, the believer is to be no longer bound. And basically, you just are letting the person go in that regard. So one of the big challenges and the things that Yeshua is really addressing with those, with that passage that we started with back there in Matthew chapter 3, Matthew chapter 19, starting in verse 3, is that you're talking about people who are both believers here together. You're working from the same grounding point. So from the same grounding point, you basically have heaven saying, "What are you doing? You have the instructions from the beginning. God made them male and female. Why do you have attraction one from the other? Where did that come from? The Creator." Okay. So thus, whatever is going on between the two of you is something that the Creator started there originally. And he said, okay, when you folk come together, you both are leaving your families to do so. You're leaving your families to come together, that you become one flesh. You know, not one and a half flesh with a part of it connected back to the family. That's not to say that you're completely dishonoring your parents, because that's another one of the instructions, the part of the Big Ten, that you are to honor your father and your mother. Why? Because that's where you come from. You honor them. And you see the added blessing in there that your days be long on the face of the earth, in the land that God has given you. Again, the blessing of the land. I'm so happy to be here in the promised land. Who promised that? Where did that come from? And again, like with from your parents, where did we come from? We came from our parents. We're not pod people. We didn't just come delivered by some courier service. by the stork or some other sort of thing that we just popped out of a shell or who knows what else. No, we come from our parents. Now, they might not be great parents, but we did come from our parents. And you may have a relationship, say, within the body of believers that are not great. But again, the ones who are creating the situation that has gotten it to the point where you're talking about walking away or having to leave or this or that. All right, well, what has broken this relationship to the point of saying, hey, this has got to end like this? Like when Paul was talking about, you have people who are not believers, they're not fully on the same page as you are on this. So thus, when there's a bond that's being broken, they're not rebelling against something, instructions they got from the beginning. They're not rebelling against what the instructions were for husband and wife to be together, to be one flesh. So that we see with these instructions that we have here in clarification from Yeshua, of what some of the key issues here. When they say, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any reason at all? And it's a, what Yeshua is clarifying is like, okay, for immorality, but that's like the nuclear option, because how did it ever get to that point to begin with, of where you're talking about either sending one of you away or leaving one of you away? Something has significantly broken down in the relationship. And we saw that with the passage we were looking at earlier in Isaiah. What has broken down in this relationship between heaven and earth to get Israel into the place where she's going to be getting a time out? The exiles are going to be coming. And it's going to be coming from a reprehensible group of people that are going to be the instrument of it. How did it get to that place? I mean, it's not just random occurrences that you had Assyria come in first to take away the northern tribes, and then Babylon came in next to take away the southern tribes. It just didn't happen randomly. Just like Shiloh, when it was Echavod was declared on that the glory had departed. That didn't just come out of nowhere. That came because, and we saw that before, it was a direct result of what was happening with the high priesthood of Israel. The ones who were supposed to be connecting people to God were not really doing so, and even driving people away from God. So continuing on with Abraham's sixfold view of marriage, number four, prayer and divine guidance. So you see, when Eleazar is going to connect with Rivka and to find someone, didn't know it was going to be Rivka, but he was praying for the guidance on this being the correct choice to be made. And you see that when Eleazar finally connects and sees the fulfillment of what his prayer was, that his prayer was indeed answered. So when we are going through our connections that we have in the body of believers as brothers and sisters in the Lord, and then also then as family units and et cetera, you know, one of the things that we should always be looking out for is a guidance on the directions to take next. As we see earlier on in Yaakov's letter in James chapter 1, when you're facing a trial, okay, when you're facing trials like persecution, these are meant to strengthen your faith, whether it's trials that come upon you to correct your behavior, or whether they're just difficulties that happen in life. We should be praying for wisdom. Why is this thing coming? What am I supposed to be learning from this? So that we can say, okay, what is it going on in my life that I need to be mature and complete, not lacking anything in regard to? I mean, you just imagine that if you have disagreements between people and some of what our prayers are right from the start is, okay, how am I supposed to mature through this? We're having a disagreement. We're having problems going on here. How am I supposed to be mature and complete and not lacking anything in resolving this? Pray for wisdom. How am I supposed to be growing here? Show me the way to go. Lead me onto the paths of everlasting. Find out everything about me, you see the psalmist talking about. And number five in Avraham's sixfold view of marriage, recognition of the value of a wife. Oh, yeah, before we go on there, Carrie's got her hand up. You want to go back or?
Yeah, just back to.
Yes.
So I grew up under certain doctrines.
Yes.
And so something that's stood out to me in more recent years is that Eliezer doesn't just ask God, show me the one.
Mm-hmm.
He has specific criteria, and mm-hmm. actually, in effect, he kind of throws the fleece out, like
yes.
the prophet.
Mm-hmm.
He tells God, in a manner of speaking, certain things he's looking for.
Yes,
and that's how he'll know that she's mm-hmm. the right one. And so that has been helpful for me in knowing that God gave us brains for a reason.
Yes,
and we're not supposed to just walk around with our eyes closed, waiting for God to just, you know, point with magic wand. He expects us to grow and have emotional maturity and be watching for people to have good character and things like that. And so we still get to choose, but having his guidance on how to choose.
Yes.
It's not always like the person, where in this instance, obviously it was. But I think for a lot of us, it's not always this like completely divine intervention. It's more about having wisdom and watching for character and people's attitude towards God even.
Yeah, and you do bring up a very interesting point in that the sign that he was looking for was for characteristics of Rivka that were going to be revealed because of this and through the answering of this. And you see a similar thing that was in one of the other great tests that's put to us in scripture with regarding Shlomo or Solomon with his great dividing the baby thing. And that in that test was to be revealing character involved, character of those two mothers. What was the character involved with that? And so that's a great point, is that in the things that when we're praying for wisdom and in the challenges that we face, that when we're praying also for the maturity that comes through the more wisdom that we get, that also will be revealing to us part of the character involved. Our character changes that we need of it, and both the character that should be formed within us as we go through this event. And sometimes we don't even know what character change is going to come with the particular trial that we're in any given time. Yeah. But you bring up a very good point, is that we should be very aware that there may be character lessons coming through the trials, and to be aware when they're coming and be open to and be teachable to say, okay, that's something going on in my character that needs to change. It needs to be refined. Oh, that's a great point. So they're on to number five, a recognition of the value of a wife, that godly wife was seen as a treasure beyond value. And one of the, you know, I think we might be able to just dismiss this. Oh, okay, this is in ancient Near East culture, and so dowries, etc. That's kind of, it can be quite reductionist to use that kind of almost anachronistic view to import our modern ideas back into an ancient culture. Now, granted, when you see compared to other ancient Near East cultures, you compare the the various codes that we have, like the code of Hammurabi, and how it talks about how you treat people, slaves, wives, etc. Pretty gruesome stuff in that. should be glad that those critics are wrong when they're saying, well, the Ten Commandments is nothing but a retread of the Code of Hammurabi. That's not in anywhere close to truth. Yeah, one example that always sticks with me is about architects or engineers. That one of the things that the code says is that if you design something and it falls down and kills somebody, well, then you get killed too. So I think engineering and architecture would be a pretty scant field right now if that was held as a standard. But yes, it was similar, very gruesome. It's called like a lex talionis, or basically the eye for an eye, but eye for an eye that is just blind. You say, okay, so you blind somebody, so I poke your eye out. But what you see actually in scripture is, no, it's about your proportionality in on this. And you're not talking about actually maiming people in the process. But so when you're talking about for the value of a wife, one of the things that you see with this also is about the treasuring of the woman who is coming into the particular family. So you see that particular view being put forward. So you're not talking about a slave, you're talking about someone of worth, and one family has to recognize the worth of the person coming into the family. But then again, is the family who is welcoming the wife into the family going to recognize the value that is coming? Or is it going to be seen as transactional? Which gets back to a similar thing that people can say regarding the laws of God, or perhaps the teachings of Paul, is that you can flip on one side or the other. It rides on a knife edge of which way you can take the interpretation. You can take the interpretation in its worst sense as, oh, this is just a sort of chattel transaction of handing someone over to a new taskmaster. Or you can say, you are having any given thing. What is your optimistic view of it? What is your pessimistic view of it? And be very cognizant of how you are making that decision one way or the other. Because there is the view that looks down on scripture as saying, this is nothing but the writings and ramblings of sun-stroked shepherds and goat herders. Or you're saying, this is the revelation of the creator of heaven and earth, and he's working with people who are not so stuck on themselves to actually listen. As people who tend to know everything, what, think they know everything and are not willing to be taught in anything more. You see, in some of the incredible great minds across the world who are at least open to something different and a different idea that would pull their mind even further were the ones that God could work with. You see, with, for example, we just mentioned with Shlomo or Solomon, that he was someone who thirsted for great wisdom. And so that's the one of the things that the Lord gave. He prayed for wisdom. And the Lord said, hey, because you've asked for this and not for riches, gold, or whatever, I'm going to give you great wisdom. And also, I'll give you great resources also. But one of the challenges that Shlomo had in his later years, and you see it reflected upon, you know, people can quibble back and forth as to whether the book of Qehelet or Ecclesiastes is actually something written by Solomon or not, but it does reflect a lot about what someone in that particular position could really fall into is to thinking, I am the fount of all wisdom and knowledge. And so I am going to then just expand my horizons and just take everything in uncritically. And you see that explored in the book of Qehelet as being what? Wind, havel, vanity. It's vain pursuit. It's nothing but wind. Because you think, oh, I'm going to pursue pleasure or wealth or wisdom or stuff or whatever. And you think that that is the source and the end of all great understanding and wisdom. But where do you really get to? It ends up being nothing in the end. Things that pass away. Things that aren't actually real. So as we move on here further, and number six, rounding out the Avraham sixfold view of marriage, purity and moral character. And you see that with one of the last things that's mentioned in the particular passage we're looking at here today in Genesis chapter 24, about Rivka's act of veiling herself as after she dismounted from the camel and found out who it was that was approaching, that she was veiling herself. And again, you might think, oh, okay, well, this is about that old-timey stuff again, and someone about wanting to maintain propriety before getting married. And we might think in modern culture that that's old-timey stuff. But what do you end up seeing in the world? We actually see, we were just talking about before, Qehelet. And I wanted to explore the depths of pleasure and found out that it was all havel. It was just all wind, just vanity, just stuff blowing in the wind. It was here before and then it was gone. We've seen that actually in modern culture today, in cultures that have gone so far down the realm of pleasure that they've gotten sick of it, where it doesn't have any sort of appeal anymore. We see examples of that in Japan was an earlier warning sign of this, and it's starting to snowball into other countries coming here, even to the United States, as to where whether the things you're actually starting to see a resurgence. Amazingly enough, Bible sales are starting to soar. I mean, they were up like 25% last year. Of what generation? The youngest generation. The youngest adults are now starting to realize, hey, this has all been havel, just vanity, pursuing after things that are not grounded, not sourced in anything true or concrete. So wanting to have something that is actually genuine. So one of the things that is actually starting to come back into vogue again is the idea of propriety. Because we've had various scandals that have been happening, and people have been thinking, oh, it's an old-timey thing to make sure that there's no sort of impropriety happening between people and how when they meet and how they meet and how they interact together. But the thing is we've seen lots of examples of it, of where the lack of propriety has led people to blow up their careers, blow up their relationships, for the sake of what? They found it in the end, it's all havel. It's all just wind, vanity, stuff that comes and it goes. And what goes with it? A whole lot of stuff that you actually value if you try to grab onto the thing that is blowing through your life in the process. So as we see all these various sixfold path of faith in God, the marriage within the context of faith, parental involvement and submission and prayer for divine guidance, recognition of the value of a wife and purity, moral character. You see, all of these things are back within our general theme that we started out with today of these various passages. Faith, divine guidance, all of these things are talking about a grounding in something that is real, not something that is havel, wind blowing. It's something that is real and genuine. And so when you see the promise of Abraham for the nations, this is a promise that is something that is real. This is genuine. Something that is a way for all of humanity to grab onto something that is real, not as fleeting as all of the various storm gods, fertility goddesses, whatever the great smorgasbord of beliefs out there will have you thinking is a source of true happiness. This is talking about happiness when you've lost everything. Happiness when you have everything. Happiness when you've have nothing left to lose. Happiness when you really have gained everything. Happiness at all times. And not just the happy is just, you know, a fake little grin on your face, but true shalom, contentment, finding rest. Because that is one of the core things that you see throughout Scripture is talking about entering his rest. So that's where we'll end things here today. Any last thoughts as we close things out? Yes, Anne, you have a comment or a question over there?
Yes, so we see Abraham looking to provide a wife for his son. All right, so I'm trying to think of some other verses somewhere where the father is seeking for a husband for a wife, I mean for his daughter. Mm-hmm. And then in the passages we saw today, the Samaritan woman comes up to Yeshua and he gives, you know, the question to draw me some water, and she drew water for him and had a conversation with him and said, "Why are you speaking to a Samaritan? This is not common." And he had a wonderful conversation with her and that. But what I'm saying, in the end, he said, "You've had five husbands, and the one you're with now is not your husband." And so, I mean, maybe in that sense, he's leading her to value the person more that would be her husband. Or, I mean, we don't see another issue where Abraham was seeking a daughter-in-law or a wife for his son, but we don't see Abraham seeking for a wife for a daughter. Maybe he has a daughter, or David seeking a wife for Tamar. Was it Tamar? Judah's daughter, I guess, was Tamar. We don't see that, or I don't know of that in the scripture where a father would be seeking for a husband for her or his daughter.
Oh,
seeking, yeah. See, we need the value.
Seeking for
needs to be valued. You know, the young woman needs to be valued as the son is valued. And they say, "Oh well, the Jews are very paternalistic and so the girls are left out." Well, that may not be true. We just don't know where or how to interpret where the father is. But our Father in heaven is the one that, you know, looking for a husband for a young woman.
Well, one of the greatest overarching ones we have is of Israel herself. I mean, the prophets talk extensively about Israel and the being the great daughter that is going to be married and to the Lord as being the husband, as that being the great model for that. And one of the things you might see is as kind of a bad example that you brought up earlier is related with seeking for a good husband for Tamar was that particular thing of first going through several husbands. And then finally, it's like, okay, the third husband that was going to be there was then kept away from her. So then she said, okay, if you want to renege on what you're supposed to be doing and finding the appropriate husband, then okay, you're going to be forced to deal with the issue. So, and thus you say with the final verdict that Yehuda has on that, it's like, yeah, she's more righteous than I on this. Right when he was getting ready to execute her, it eventually comes back around to say, hey, this is, you were not acting justly on this in really seeking Tamar's interests on it. Any other thoughts? Yes, Lorella, go ahead, please.
I just had a nugget that I am going to take with me for the day of, I just, when you said that our youth are buying more Bibles, I remember when my kids were rebelling, and I look at it as the youth of today are looking at how empty their parents' lives have become without walking in the way. And so they're going to rebel and come closer to God. And I love the idea that if you're going to rebel into righteousness, isn't that amazing?
Yeah. But then that behooves for the next generation to not flip-flop it and to remember the lesson of why you then fled toward righteousness and say, okay, I don't want to make them flee from righteousness for the next generation after that.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info. Hallel.info.